Where was I?
Tell your men to drop their swords, Sula. Tell your men to drop their swords, Sula.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, I bring you the latest dispatch from Gaul, where the iridescent Gaius Julius Caesar has been making the most of a gap year. This dispatch has it all. Fighting, battles, the taking of hostages, the building of bridges. Julius Caesar, he'll make you take your clothes off and go dancing in the Rhine, is a force to be reckoned with. But, my good citizens and slaves, I can hear you asking it now. This is all very well and good, but what are the Suebi up to? Well, fortunately for you, I have 10 chapters that address this very subject. In the following winter, the year in which Gnaeus Pompeius and Marcus Crassus were consuls, the Usipetes from Germany, and likewise the Tencteri, crossed the Rhine with a large host of men,
not far from the sea into which it flows. The reason for their crossing was that for several years they had been much harassed by the Suebi, who pressed on them by force of arms and prevented them from husbandry. They did not let them keep sheep.
Yes, well, I mean, that word husbandry gets used a lot in this translation. I guess we should gloss it as...
cattle.
Yeah.
And sundry.
Keeping animals.
Sure. So the year of the consuls there, that dates this quite handily to 55 BCE.
Well, and we know by now, I think we're in the rhythm of a book a year, yes. Pretty much.
Yep, yeah. And the Suebi. Suebi? Encountered previously. Briefly.
Yeah. There's a lot of references back to book one in this book, certainly in this section, because, of course, that's the last time we had the Germani, the Germanic peoples, featuring strongly in the second half of book one. And indeed, that's where they had come in because they tried to join forces with those who were following Ariovistus, the Germanic king who was defeated by Caesar in book one. But Caesar had prevented them even joining in. So they didn't form a huge part of that conflict in book one.
No,
so
this is kind it was of foreshadowing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And we've got similar patterns, as we'll see. You know, somebody from the Gauls is in trouble and therefore Caesar has to interfere because the Germani are causing trouble.
Mm. And while they are talked about extensively here at the start of book four, what do you call it, ethnography?
Yeah.
Little bit of ethnography from Caesar to start off book four. They aren't the main villains in this book.
Well, I guess they put pressure on the Germanic peoples that Caesar has to deal with.
The other two that were mentioned, two that I can't pronounce ever.
The Usipetes and the Tencteri.
You took the words right out of my mouth there. Yeah, those
so
guys.
The Suebi are hugely powerful and they're kind of the focus of the ethnography.
Mm.
But we should get clear in our minds that while the Suebi, who seem to be a kind of collection of Germanic peoples, to be honest, are very powerful and important and indeed... Caesar says in chapter one that they are by far the largest and most warlike nation. And he uses the word bellicosissima, which is a great big long word meaning very, very warlike. They are also, we should clarify in our minds, they're not necessarily the people that Caesar's fighting straight away in this book because he has to deal with the Usipetes and Tencteri who are pushing into Gaul because they themselves have been pressured by the Suebi. So there's this kind of general westward movement and the Suebi are standing behind it all.
Okay. So because this is what Caesar does, which is narratively poor form, let's forget about the direct threat that we're going to be dealing with now and just talk about the Suebi.
Are you having a go at Caesar?
Yeah, I am. This is really poorly structured on Caesar's part.
Well, I think it's deliberate in that it points out how important the Suebi are. They're the force behind all of this.
No, Caesar's sword is mightier than his pen, I think. So who are the Suebi then? What are we told about them?
They're sort of unbelievably huge, not just the people themselves, but the number of them. They're the largest nation, according to Caesar. And he says that they have, in the translation, it's 100 cantons. And the word he uses that gets translated as canton, which sort of sounds French, is pagus.
I know what neither of these things are.
Well, it means a grouping of peoples, a community.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so... And there is a little bit of negativity, almost ethnic denigration, you could say. It's a word that you'd only use of the countryside, of not quite so civilized. It's not an urban population, if you say Pagus. All right, it's not the word for state, and it's not the word for city. Usually it's used of other peoples.
Okay.
And it is actually the word that eventually gives us pagan.
Oh, okay.
So you can
yes,
see that
yes,
Christianity
yes.
takes it on as a kind of othering word.
And so Caesar gives a description of how the Suebi organize their troops, if you can call them troops. That's probably the wrong word. But anyway, they rotate between fighting and farming. So I guess that leaves them fresh and providing food at all times.
Yeah, he makes it sound like quite a good system. So the same people, the same men presumably, can go from being farmers on the land to a period where they're the fighting force. So he says, they make not much use of corn for food. They do have some agriculture apparently, but not much, he says, but chiefly of milk and of cattle. And they are much engaged in hunting. And this owing to the nature of the food, the regular exercise and the freedom of life. For from boyhood, they are not schooled in a sense of duty or discipline and do nothing whatever against their wish. It's a nice little aside there. This nurses their strength and makes men of immense bodily stature. So that's the bigness in the individual bodies that I mentioned. Moreover, they have regularly trained themselves to wear nothing, even in the coldest localities, except skins, the scantiness of which leaves a great part of the body bare. And they bathe in the rivers. I'm always taken by the way that's just tacked on at the end. Not only do they wear almost nothing in northern Germany, where it's pretty cold.
Yes.
But also they bathe in rivers, which is both sub-civilized, because of course one of the really strong characteristics when you think of Roman civilization is their bath buildings.
Yes, yeah.
So this is a real contrast with Roman society, as it were. But also, of course, it shows their toughness. Not only do they not have to wear very much, they don't make textiles, they just wear skins, and they don't have very much of that, but they bathe in nature.
So while he's talking them down a bit, he's also building them up as a threat, and I detect a slight bit of admiration there.
Yeah, and this is quite typical of Roman ethnography and will be really developed very strongly by Tacitus, particularly with regard to the Germani in his work, The Germania. Which is another work on our list of things to go through. You can chop that out if you want.
No,
you
now that you've said it, it's part of the record now, and you've got to do it at some point.
I love the Germania. I would love to talk about it in more detail. Yeah, so as a Roman, you would sniff at how uncivilized they are. They don't have what the Romans called humanitas. So, you know, they don't sit down and read literature of an evening or whatever, or listen to it being read to them. But they have military prowess because they're really tough in their bodies and they spend a lot of time concentrating on being tough. And the very fact that Caesar says they go between fighting and farming plays back into this long-standing stereotype of the perfect man and the perfect society from the point of view of the Romans, because they think of themselves as what this used to be. So they talk about men from their early, perhaps legendary history of going just automatically between the farm and the battlefield. And when the battle's over, even if they've been a military leader, they just go straight back to the farming. And of course, this is not happening at all by the late Republic. They've got a professional army. Maybe when they retire, they'll get given some land to farm. But that's not their life, not this routine of going between these two. So there's a hint of nostalgia as well as admiration here.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Very much a simpler way of life.
Yeah. Part of the badness, though, is that freedom that he talks about. Freedom's a good thing as opposed to being a slave. Libertas. Libertas is a word used here. But too much freedom, just not doing anything you don't want to do, suggests that you don't subject yourself to the will of the state.
The other bad thing, though, he wades into now by documenting their lack of trade.
Yeah. Well, again, you could read this as a good or a bad, couldn't you? They don't have widespread trade. And a little later on, he tells us they don't like wine, although he then says because
not
they
even a tittle.
They regard it as effeminate, something that softens you.
Okay.
And I mean, elsewhere, certainly in Tacitus, there will be talk of they just drink this strange beer thing. He doesn't call it beer, but, you know, yeasty, weird stuff that you make from grain.
Yeah,
they don't really understand it. And yeah, we've seen this before relating to other peoples. We've seen it with the Gauls themselves, but in those very northeastern Gauls, the Belgae. Mm-hmm. And there, right at the beginning of Caesar's work in Book One, it was stated that the reason they're the toughest is that they don't engage in trade because they're so far away from Roman trading routes. And also they're close to the Germani and they fight them all the time and are influenced by them.
Sure.
This maybe very far from the truth, but it's the pattern that Caesar's decided to set up, that those people further away are tougher and also further from trade.
But I guess, you know, ultimately it's telling the story that he wants to tell. A sign of a barbaric enemy is somebody who doesn't engage in trade.
Yeah, but he makes it sound quite deliberate on the part of these peoples. He doesn't say it's a total lack of trade. He says, and I quote, that they give access to traders rather to secure purchases for what they have captured in war than to satisfy any craving for imports. So they export stuff, stuff they've stolen.
Stuff they've stolen, yes.
But they don't import.
Yeah.
That vocabulary, rather than to satisfy any craving for imports, that kind of idea that you become dependent on these luxuries. And these people aren't. They're tough. They're kind of self-sufficient.
But in the plus column, they're good at training horses.
They are, yeah. And this again comes down to a sort of looking down on other people as soft who can't do this, because they're very skilled at this and they train their horses well. But they got this real moral precept that they will not ride horses with saddles.
Mm.
They'll attack a much larger number of cavalry if the people on them are wearing saddles, because they regard that as kind of soft, a sign of softness. These people will be easy to defeat if they actually need a saddle.
Oh, okay. Yes, I see what you mean. It shows a level of command over the animal, I suppose.
It does. And it shows on their part a contempt for people who need that.
Yes.
If you need the saddle, you're clearly not really a good horseman.
Mm. So the next bit of his ethnography makes note of how much territory they cover. It doesn't seem to be like a solid, defined block or anything like that. It's just whatever they can see.
Yeah, this is chapter 3, and he makes this rather weird statement, not only that they have a lot of land, but that they want a lot of land that is just empty around their land.
So everything the light touches is your kingdom.
Yeah, but also it's not your kingdom in terms of you've inhabited it or used it for anything.
Yeah.
That he says, this is a quote, as a nation they count it the highest praise to have land on their borders untenanted.
Oh, so they don't count the dark space over there.
No, they want it to be big. I know you're quoting something, I have no idea what it is.
The listener at home is now yelling, "The Lion King, the Lion King."
Oh, I've never seen it.
what?
So the important thing that Caesar's stating here, let me carry on with the quote and then we'll unpack it.
Yes, sir.
He says, this signifies, they think, that a great number of states cannot withstand their force. So this is something that gives them authority.
Mm, they're given a wide berth. It's just don't go anywhere near them.
Yeah, I think it works two ways. It works as we've got so much land, we can afford to just not use some of it.
Mm.
But also we've got that kind of tract of land that is a buffer zone.
Mm-hmm.
So that will maintain our power because we can contain it within. So it's barren, it's uninhabited, it's unworked. And the figure that's mentioned is 600 miles on every side.
Yeah,
I mean, like most figures, when we talk about numbers of people involved in battles, it's pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, but regardless, it's a huge tract of land.
Yeah, it's meant to make you think.
Sure.
They're so powerful, they've got so much land, they can just leave this land.
Mm.
And it would sound very weird to the Romans, this idea that you would bother to do this. Because, of course, within their empire, one of the ways that they kind of sort out their borders is to have friendly people close to it.
Mm.
So there might be incursions within your territory or your provinces. So what you want to ensure is that the people on the borders are those who maybe have been called friends of the Roman people.
Yeah.
And then if someone attacks them, they're your buffer, not just empty spaces.
Okay, so speaking of nearby friends, the Ubii,
mm-hmm.
Is that something that I remembered or I'm just guessing? I don't know.
I think you're getting Latin pronunciation.
Jeez, it only took me, 10 episodes. Are closest to them geographically, but they are very different.
Yeah, so they're closest to the Suebi,
but
they're much more civilized.
Okay.
All right, he says they're humaniores, so that's the comparative form of that, that word related to humanitas that I was talking about. Interestingly, he then talks about them having a state, a civitas. He doesn't talk about them having pagi or cantons. All right, which is a bit disparaging.
Okay, so.
As he does with the Swabi.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason that they are more civilized, again, it's down to proximity. Their land touches the Rhine, so they have trade.
Okay.
And they know about Gallic ways. We go back to, and we'll see this much more strongly if we ever get to book six, that the Gauls are the ones with a degree of civilization, the Germani without, but the Germani who are close to the Gauls might have sort of contracted some of this civilization.
Right. And this is why I say that Caesar is not good at structuring a story, not good at structuring a narrative here. So forget everything that we just learned about the Swabi, apparently.
He has a connector.
Yeah, oh, sure. Forget the Swabi. Caesar is now confronting the people that are scared of the Swabi.
Okay, so the connection is that the Swabi demand tribute from the Ubii, but they haven't conquered them as such.
Yeah.
So they're kind of
vassals.
Yeah, they're vassals. That's a good word for it. And then he says the Usipetes and the Tencteri are in the same position.
Okay.
So they're also vassals of the Swabi.
So the Usipetes and the Tencteri are almost refugee status, which we've seen before in Caesar's Gallic War.
Well, that happens now because it's not in the Swabi desire is not enough for them to pay tribute. They want to be in on their land. So the Swabi push them out. And because they push them out of their own territory, they end up in the land of the Menapii, which is on the Rhine. And this is just getting too close for comfort.
All right. So what do the Usipetes and the Tencteri do?
Well, they clearly want to cross over the Rhine, although they can't do it because they have no ships, which is a bit of a problem. They're technologically incapacitated here.
And the Rhine is a formidable force of water, which you would need a ship to cross it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's really wide in this part. So in chapter 4, Caesar is talking about the Menapii, and he says, so they were put to the sword and their vessels seized. Right, this is so the Usipetes and Tencteri can get across. Then the Germani, i.e. the Usipetes and Tencteri, crossed the river before the section of the Menapii on the near side of the Rhine could learn of it.
Right,
the Menapii
so
on both sides of the Rhine.
Yeah. Yeah.
They seized all their buildings, and for the remainder of the winter, they sustained themselves on the supplies of the Menapii.
Right, okay.
So this is the problem. They've come into Menapii territory, which is on the Gallic side of the Rhine, and now they've sort of potentially brought themselves into the remit of Caesar. However, Caesar doesn't react immediately because he doesn't necessarily believe that this is going on, which is interesting.
Is that because he possibly believes that nobody would dare to do that when, well, when Caesar is so close?
Maybe that's in the back of his mind. But what he claims is that he doesn't believe the Gauls always tell true stories.
Okay.
He thinks they make stuff up and they cry wolf. Fearing the fickleness of the Gauls, he says, because they are capricious in forming designs and intent for the most part on change. So they just can't stand still. This is part of his characterization of the Gauls that comes back again and again.
Yeah.
And he considered no trust should be reposed in them. In fact, he gives a whole paragraph at this point, if people want to read chapter 5 of book 4, on how unreliable Gallic narratives are. They make stuff up, then there's rumor, then they pass it on. He says they are slaves to uncertain rumor.
Yeah.
They'll believe anything. So he's been burned before he decides that he wants more information here.
It's still something that he's got to check out that, because if there's actually a threat there,
yeah,
then it's going to be something that he needs to deal with.
I do wonder whether chapter 5 isn't all about, it wasn't just a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
I checked this out first.
Okay.
Because the next thing we know in chapter 6, he returns to the army early so that he can prepare them.
For fear that otherwise he might have to face a more serious campaign. So nip this in the bud.
Yeah, exactly.
And decides to make war with the Germani. Gather up the troops, off he goes.
Yeah, and of course, importantly, right at the beginning of chapter 7, having secured the corn supply, he gets the grain together.
Yep.
And he moves on the Germani. Immediately, the Germani attempt to make peace with him. They're instantly scared. He says, they claim, this is kind of indirect speech, they had come against their will, being driven out of their homes. If the Romans would have their goodwill, they might find their friendship useful. So
yeah.
They're pretty scared. And they see the Swabi.
Sorry about the Menapii.
Yeah, exactly. They've burned their houses. They've kind of stolen all of their food, probably killed a lot of them. They're really worried about the Swaybe, they claim. They yielded to the Swaybe alone, to whom even the immortal gods could not be equal.
Oh, see, I saw this as a bit of an arrogant thing, you know. We're not going to yield to you, Caesar. We only yield to the Swaybe. They're the really scary guys.
Yeah, look, it could well be in that tone. Certainly the Romans could read it like that, couldn't they?
And maybe Caesar would be annoyed at that, going, no, we really are dangerous. You should want to yield to us.
Well, he kind of represents himself as being forced to get involved in this local land dispute, which is seeping over into his territory. Mm. And I think partly he's building up the Swaybe as well. So I think he's maybe got it both ways, that the Roman reader would feel, well, they should be scared of us. But also, well, the Swaybe do sound pretty intimidating. Caesar says they can't come in.
Which he has said before to people in the same situation. Bugger off.
Gaul is full.
Back across the Rhine with you.
He says he can't reward them while they remain in Gaul. So while they're in this Menapii territory, it would look bad if he just let them hang around.
Look, fair enough, yeah.
They had permission, he says, if they pleased, to settle in the territories of the Ubii, who, remember, are back over the other side. Great for the Ubii. Oh,
yeah, I was about
we're
to
just
say,
going to have these people land on us.
Yeah, thanks, Caesar.
We're the ones who were friendly to you, and this is what we get.
Yeah.
The Germani ask for 3 days, this delaying tactic we saw in book one with the Helvetii.
Mm.
Remember, and Caesar always represents himself as being alert to what's going on. In book one, he used that time to get his troops closer. And here he sort of thinks, well, I know that it's a tactic while they wait for their cavalry. I'm not fooled, but he gives them the 3 days anyway.
Mm.
And then I suppose you're not going to like this. We go into a geography lesson.
No.
Is this too much of an aside?
I'm fine with geography.
Actually, chapter 10 of book 4, some older editors delete. They kind of don't like these asides.
To the extent where you would delete it.
Yeah, the whole chapter.
Isn't that interesting?
They claim, it is interesting. They delete parts of the very first chapter too. They don't like the fact that he goes on so much about the shape of Gaul and where people live.
Well, they are at least agreeing with me that Caesar needs a decent editor.
I'd like to hear you say that to his face.
It's very easy for me to say, well, there's a good 2,000 years separating us and, you know, half the world. But come here and make me stop it, Caesar. Mm. Yeah.
Those who would edit this out claim that it's very close to what a later geographer, Strabo, who's writing under the Emperor Tiberius, too close to his description. Which is possibly a circular argument because we know that Strabo read Caesar and based his description partly on what Caesar had written. Can I read it out?
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
He says, on its approach to the ocean, the Rhine divides into several streams, forming many large islands, a great number of which are inhabited by fierce barbaric tribes, believed in some instances to live on fish and birds' eggs, which is, I guess, is less weird than what some ethnographies say that weird people at the extremities live on.
Mm.
Then by many mouths it flows into the ocean.
Okay.
It's a little poetic.
Well, I'm glad we know that. Anyway, back to the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so he's given them 3 days, but in chapter 11, the ambassadors from the Germani try to stall for another 3 days, and they ask Caesar to stop coming closer to grant themselves an opportunity of sending deputies into the land of the Ubii.
But Caesar literally believes that they're stalling for time here.
He does. Literally waiting for the cavalry as well. He says that. That's not just an analogy here. Mm. Remember, he said, well, you can go and live with the Ubii. So they're saying, well, we have to make contact with them. He gives them 1 day and he gets his troops ready. Meanwhile, he sent instructions to the commanders who had gone forward with all the cavalry not to provoke the enemy to an engagement. And if provoked themselves, to hold their ground until he himself with the army had come nearer.
Mm. So the Germans are putting it off. We need another 3 days. We need another 3 days because more of our men are on their way.
Yes.
And, you know, we need more men because we're going
to fight
Caesar.
Well, they're not saying that openly.
No, of course. No, why would they? But Caesar surmises everybody be on the lookout and just be ready.
But he's very careful to frame it as, I told the troops not to provoke the conflict themselves.
Yes.
All right. So he's not picking a fight with the Germani. He's just ready for war. He's ready for war if they start it.
The enemy had no more than 800 cavalry, for the party which had gone across the Meuse to get the corn had not yet returned. Our own men, 5,000 strong, had nothing to fear, for the deputies of the Germans had left Caesar but a short while before, having asked for a truce that day. This is still dealing with the two Germanic tribes, Usipetes and Tencteri, although they're not referred to very often. They're just given the name Germans. And they are safely outnumbered. So it's 800 versus 5,000.
Yeah, which makes it rather surprising that in chapter 12, directly they saw our cavalry, the enemy charged and speedily threw our men into confusion.
Yes, but he spent, you know, a good part of this book telling us how barbaric they are.
No, I mean, it's surprising that they charge, given how outnumbered they are.
Yeah, but...
And then they must know that their own cavalry, a lot of it has gone to get supplies.
But they've got no strategy or anything.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. They're not sensible.
They're unstructured. They don't drink wine, you know. The Romans are taken by surprise by this, though.
Slightly, yes. They weren't expecting them to do something as silly as that, I guess.
Yes.
The Usipetes and Tencteri, they have a particular tactic, which is effective to a degree. They, and I quote, stab our horses and bring down many of our troops to the ground.
That's brutal.
Yeah, poor horses.
Yeah, effective.
They put the rest to rout and indeed drove them in such panic that they did not desist from flight until they were come in sight of our column.
Mm.
So this is a bad moment for the Romans and quite surprising given the imbalance in numbers.
Despite this confusion, it isn't a great loss for the Romans. We're told 74 Roman cavalry are slain, which is really precise for Caesar.
So
I really don't know what to make of his numbers. You know, 5,000, you know, we slew great many. Oh, we lost 74 guys.
Well, I think that he's being precise to show that there were losses. Mm. This was not great, but it was fairly contained.
Yes. But we do get detail of one of the fallen.
Yeah, which is rare.
But, yeah.
And he is called gallant, very gallant indeed, fortissimus, very brave, a man called Piso of Aquitania. Which means that he is a Gaul who's been Romanized, who has Roman citizenship.
Ah, okay, yeah.
He is described as, and the language here is great in the translation, the scion of a most distinguished line whose grandfather had held the sovereignty in his own state and had been saluted as friend by the Roman Senate. So he comes from a very noble line in Aquitania in southwest.
So this goes all the way back to Gaul as a whole being divided into three parts. Yeah. One was the Aquitani.
It was.
Yes.
Well remembered. back in book one. There's also a rather tragic story that's told associated with Piso in that he gets killed because he goes in to try and save his brother.
Yes.
And he succeeds in doing this, but in the process he himself is cut down. Then his brother comes back to try and defend him and also gets killed.
Yes, totally negating the fact that, yeah, okay. Very cinematic.
Yeah, but and it's kind of fraternal piety, you know, this what the Romans call pietas, duty to your family, which is existing among the Galli, albeit Romanized Gauls. Perhaps not as surprising. So. But you know, Caesar doesn't often talk about individuals in the troops, but every now and again you'll get a story of immense bravery.
But usually, you know, you can tell why he's doing that because they're from a notable Roman family. This guy is definitely not. But then I guess maybe it's kind of showing you a not all barbarians view of the barbarians.
Yeah, and as I say, he's a Romanized barbarian.
So that happened quickly. That was unexpected.
Mm.
But Caesar now decides that the time for peace is over.
Yeah.
You've had your 3 days. You had your extra day. Now look what you've done.
Well, they've attacked basically for no reason, according to Caesar's description of it anyway. So he says there can be no peace because of their treachery. He uses the words dolum, which means a trick, and insidias, which can mean an ambush or a trap. So he decides he's got to attack them quickly.
Mm.
He judged it the height of madness to wait until the enemy's forces should be increased and their cavalry returned. Why wait for them to get strong again? And also before they can make any plans. And he talks here about the fickleness of the Gauls, which you might think is a bit random. These are Germani. But what he seems to be indicating is that this weakness or fickleness, infirmitas, he calls it, infirmity of the Gauls, they might be inspired into some kind of crazy action if they see that the Romans are being defeated. So this is not a good look within Gaul. He needs to act quickly. And he doesn't really explain this fully in the text. So if you're a bit confused about who's on which side here.
And you're there going, wait a minute, I thought they were fighting Germans.
Yeah, exactly.
At the moment. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The reason is that he thinks it might have a flow-on effect to how the Romans are perceived by Gauls.
So for Caesar, our narrator, most fortunately, as he says, the high-ranking Germans don't seem to know that this attack by their cavalry is going on, so that comes back to barbarians being unorganized.
Well, they at least, at the very least, don't recognize that it negates their chances of negotiating because they turn up and try to clear themselves. Caesar says that they're using deceit here, perfidio and simulatio. So simulatio is pretense.
Mm.
They want to get what they could in respect of a truce, or in respect of the truce. But Caesar, there's nothing beholden to him now. He doesn't have to respect them.
Yes.
So he just detains them as hostages.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? They attacked first.
And from then on in, the war's over pretty quickly in chapter 14.
Then in person, he led the troops out of the camp, commanding the cavalry, which he judged to be shaken by the recent engagement, to follow in the rear. That's an interesting kind of tactic. Well, it isn't just a pull your socks up, men, kind of thing.
Mm.
It's a, no, you've had a hard day.
Yeah.
Kind of a soft touch approach.
Yeah, I guess so. And notice that he's in charge.
Mm.
He's not using
yes.
a subordinate.
I think that that's the more important thing that I should have realised is that Caesar's leading the way here.
Very hands-on.
So the war, it's not even a war. It's not even a battle. But, you know, 5,000 against 800, I think we said earlier. It's over very quickly.
Yeah, they take the Germani by surprise, draw up their battle line really quickly.
Mm.
So the Romans do everything quickly,
have
you noticed?
Yeah.
There's going to be more coming up. And they overrun the German camp. And to quote, the Germani were struck with sudden panic by everything. Rapidity of our approach, the absence of their own chiefs. And as no time was given them to think or to take up arms, they were too much taken aback to decide what was best, to lead their forces against the enemy, to defend the camp, or to seek safety by flight. They don't even have time to think.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a very rhetorical passage that then it's kind of the rapidity of the language itself. It really mirrors what's going on in the Germani camp and in their minds.
We're told that Caesar sends the cavalry after them as they flee, after the women and children and
everyone. Yeah, because as he mentions, the Germani have brought everything with them.
And
that's not surprising. They've had to leave their territory. They're not far from where the fighting's taking place, which Tacitus will later tell us is a typical Germanic ploy, that the women are always around even during the battle. But when the women and children flee, Caesar sends the cavalry in pursuit. He doesn't tell us what happens. Do they get killed? Do they get captured?
No, but we're told when they reach the junction of the Meuse and the Rhine, the Meuse, the Meuse. What is that? Is that another river?
Yes.
Okay. Where was that in our geography lesson, Caesar?
Yeah, well.
Okay. They gave up hope of escaping further. A large number were already slain and the rest hurled themselves into the river, there to perish, overcome by terror, by exhaustion, by the force of the stream.
It's pretty ruthless, isn't it?
Yeah. Very morbid. Anyway, battle, as if you could call it that, is over.
Mm.
No Romans were killed. None at all. That's how quick they were.
Seems unlikely. A few were wounded.
No. If there was one, he would have told us.
No, he says a few were wounded.
Yeah. A few were wounded.
He doesn't say that all of these were killed, but he does say that there were, wait for it, 430,000 of the enemy.
That doesn't even include the cavalry. Why wait for cavalry if you've got that many men? Because Caesar had 5,000.
Well, he's not very clear on this. This could include all of the troops that hadn't yet come, in my view.
Regardless, he releases the hostages because he doesn't need them anymore.
Yeah. But ironically, they don't want to go home, fearing punishments and tortures at the hands of the Gauls whose lands they had harassed. So they haven't made themselves popular in Gaul.
Mm.
They said they would stay in his company and he gave them liberty to do so.
Yeah, there's a lot of surprising things in that one statement. A very early version of Stockholm Syndrome. Now we get to the point where Caesar decides to cross the Rhine because he knows there's a force of German cavalry over there who are going to come and make war with him at some point. So he's going to take the fight to them.
Yeah. Look, this is something that he has made logical within his own narrative, that the Usipetes, the Tencteri, and even worse, the Suebi are all a problem. But when it comes down to it, I do wonder if he just didn't want to build a big bridge.
The bridge is a statement.
The bridge is absolutely a statement, as we'll see as we go through this. I mean, it's kind of all he needs to do.
Mm.
So if we talk about fighting the Germani in this section of the Gallic War, he doesn't really need to do much fighting once he's built this.
Yes, they are so intimidated by the bridge.
And he says, look, he says at the outset of chapter 16, this is the quote, "The Germani so easily induced to enter Gaul, he wished to make them fearful in turn for their own fortunes." So he wants to stop them from doing that again, as you said, by showing them that a Roman army could and durst cross the Rhine.
Mm.
I love the word durst.
This is another ye olde word that I'm not familiar with very often.
It should.
Yeah.
So he kind of sums up what's happened to the Usipetes and Tencteri, the ones that had gone off for supplies.
Yeah.
They have withdrawn to the territory of the Sugambri and joined up with them. Now, they're on, at least on the correct side of the Rhine.
Okay.
Right? They're on the eastern side, the Germanic side, just south of where the Usipetes and Tencteri traditionally live. They haven't been able to go back to their own territory because of the Suebi, but they've gone back to close by. But the fact that they've joined up with another Germanic group on the banks of the Rhine makes them look like a threat.
Okay. So Caesar wants to send a message to them.
Yeah, and initially he demands surrender.
Mm.
And they kind of give him the finger in this quote. This quote really reminds me of the debate. It's not quite the same territory they're talking about, but the debate he had with Ariovistus back in book one, where Ariovistus said, stay in your own bit of Gaul, stay in the province. And Caesar said, well, you stay on your own side of the Rhine. So they're basically arguing about all of that bit of Gaul between the province in the southeast and the Rhine as that eastern border.
Mm.
Anyway, so that's book one. Here we have a sort of rerun of that with a different group, the Usipetes and Tencteri. These Germanic people say that the Rhine marked the limit of the Roman Empire. So they've kind of accepted that now, which Ariovistus didn't back in book one. So that's an interesting change.
They saw what happened to Ariovistus.
If he thought it unfair that the Germani should cross into Gaul against his will, why did he claim any imperial power across the Rhine? They're arguing that he shouldn't extend his power across the Rhine. Caesar, I guess, would say, well, I'm just trying to stop you getting over to my side. So there are lots of groups involved here. We'll try not to get confused. But on top of the Tencteri and the Usipetes being kind of bolshy about this, the Ubii...
You've got the Sugambri as well. Okay, so the Ubii, though, they're friendly.
The Ubii are friendly. They're the only Germanic peoples
across the Rhine, who are friendly.
They want help against the Suebi.
Yes.
And again, it's like book one where the Aedui said, Ariovistus is going to be a problem. He's been harassing us for years.
Mm.
The Ubii, when they ask for help, and Caesar kind of can argue that he owes it to them a little bit, because back in book two, he asked the people across the Rhine to send him representatives, to send legati to kind of ensure peace. And they were the only ones who sent any.
Mm.
They offer boats to assist with the crossing. They mention that Caesar is now famous in Germania after defeating Ariovistus. So we get a reference. We're reminded of his defeat of Ariovistus here, but in the mouths of the Ubii.
So a lot of this is just a retread of book one, isn't it?
Well, it kind of...
Just a copy and paste with new names.
No, it's not that at all.
And a bridge.
There are shared themes. The bridge makes a huge difference, though. But yeah, he has the Ubii bring up Ariovistus here, is meant to remind us of that. And we see similar patterns that we've been pointing out all the way along.
This is just a loving homage to book one. or a trashy remake, depending on your perspective.
We did say in book one that there was a lot of explaining why he was in certain places, and we are getting some more of that here as well.
So Caesar builds a bridge and gets over it.
Yes. In all kinds of senses.
Yes.
I think this is weird. Don't you think this is weird at the start of chapter 17 that he says boats lack dignity?
I don't need your boats.
They're unworthy of his own and the Roman people's dignity.
This is Caesar. He's famous. he defeated Ariovistus. He doesn't need a boat.
Ordinary people go over by boat.
That's right.
It's, yeah, basically a bridge or nothing.
Yes. It's propaganda building as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, boats would be a lot of back and forth. People would be falling into the water. It is quite undignified.
Some of those Germani don't even have boats, so even boats would impress them.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. But, you know, a bridge, I can see why a bridge would drive home a bit of fear.
Mm.
Yeah.
to quote from chapter 17, confronted with the greatest difficulty in making a bridge by reason of the breadth, the rapidity and the depth of the river, he still thought he must make that effort or else not take his army across.
Yeah.
So again, it's rhetorically strong here. The idea is that, you know, quite often we get peoples like the Swabi say described as really threatening, a hugely scary enemy. And this time the river itself is kind of a scary prospect.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's not just a bridge. It's a bridge crossing the Rhine. This is such a vast river that you'd stand on one side and you'd have trouble seeing the other side, maybe?
Well, the notes in the back of the lurb, which are also available in the online version, tell us that the present breadth, and these things do change slightly over time, of course, but it won't have changed that much, of the Rhine at this place, which is modern Koblenz, is about 400 yards, which is about 365 meters.
Okay.
That's a long way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm quite impressed that he built a bridge over that river.
Yeah, no kidding. You're meant to be. And, you know, I am reminded of those documentaries that you see from time to time where this is one of the things they try and do is recreate a bridge like Caesar's with the technology that was available at the time. And they can never do it.
Mm.
It's always really hard. Or they construct a bit of it, but they're not really sure they could do all of it.
But that's also because they're reading texts like this and they're going, right, we've got to follow this word for word and do it. Otherwise, you know, we're failing at it. And Caesar tells us just how quickly he does it, which I'm probably jumping too far ahead here, I think, by telling us that, how many days was it? It was like
10 days.
10 days. Ten days.
I think one of the differences, and I'm sure they do take this into account when they try and do these reconstructions of this, but one of the big differences is, you know, how many volunteers can you get to come and build your modern version of Caesar's Bridge?
So. Yep.
He has thousands of troops.
Yep.
You know, in a way, it's also a demonstration of manpower that he can do this so quickly.
And shout out to the unspoken architect, I suppose, who designed this. They don't get a mention.
Well, actually, I think we do know who the architect is.
Do we?
That he may not be mentioned here
in
this book, but it's Mamura.
Okay.
Who, in another episode of something we've done in Emperors of Rome when we talked about Catullus, he wrote a poem having a go at Mamura.
Wow.
And he called him Mentula, which means penis.
I was about to say, wow, good on you for remembering this, and that's
You may want to cut all of that. But yeah, Mamura was his chief engineer.
All right. So we do get extensive details about this bridge, which helps for anybody try to recreate it.
Yeah, and also I should mention that the lurb has a nice little diagram in the back, which you can also get to from the online version on Lacus Curtius by going from the front page and looking at the maps and diagrams
for
the bridge across the Rhine. And that'll probably help you to envisage this better than we can by describing it. So basically he has these long posts, or in the translation bulks, which are really thick, which are put down into the riverbed, and then they are at an angle to each other, so they form a triangle.
Yeah.
And then lays across that the bridge itself.
Mm. So the thinking about doing it that way, you know, being the structural engineer, I know this, or I just read a book that told me this, is that the angle that they're on means that the strength of the current from the river just makes it stronger because it's forcing it against each other.
Yeah, rather than putting them in straight where all the force of the river comes against it at once, I guess, and knocks it over. And like you, I should say, I don't know a lot about engineering, but it looks like that on the plan, and it, my slight knowledge of physics makes it sound right.
Yes, that sounds right, yes. And also, Germans can't just float tree trunks down the river to destroy it.
Mm.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, so there's a lot of thought gone into this, a lot of engineering expertise. And the river is pretty deep, as Caesar has mentioned, so it's amazing that they do it. It's both wide and deep.
Mm. So Caesar builds his impressive bridge in 10 days across the Rhine, across the bridge, leaving men at either side, by the way, we should say, so that it doesn't get attacked, which is sound. Do not let your bridge get cut down while you're on the wrong side
of it. And also just so people don't flood across it into Gaul.
Yeah,
so
well,
the Germani don't use it as a route.
Yeah, it's like, hey, we can cross quite easily now. Way, thanks, Romans. So several state deputies came to him. So several different German tribes.
Yeah, he's not specific on who they are, but they're intimidated by the bridge.
Yes.
And they request peace and friendship, which he is fine with.
Yes.
Replies in generous fashion, as he says, and they just have to give him some hostages to ensure that they are safe.
Okay, so the bridge is working, but it's possibly working on the wrong people. The people that he's worried about are the Sugambri.
And they've basically fled to the woods. They've gathered supplies and evacuated.
So they've entrenched themselves and, you know, come at me, Caesar, kind of thing.
Well, he does attack the villagers. He burns all the villages, buildings and crops. So they have nothing to come back to. He doesn't go into the woods to pursue them. As you say, he's made his point.
If they haven't got their crops and their villages, they're in trouble anyway.
Yeah, exactly. He withdraws to Ubi territory, which is, of course, friendly land, friendly allies, where he learns that the Swabi have withdrawn and they're also hidden away.
Mm.
They are ready to make a stand on their chosen territory.
So these are the guys that we should be scared of.
Yeah, and it's worked on them too. They've hidden away. They say, you know, they're kind of giving these brave words, but they're not there, are they?
Mm.
So Caesar is kind of prepares to leave and promises to help the Ubi if they need it, if the Swabi come back and press them. We're basically told that the Swabi have heard about the bridge being built and it made them panic. And in fact, we get a bit more detail about it lower down in chapter 19. They hold a council. They send messages to all their districts because, remember, they've got a huge number of different districts.
Mm.
And they tell them all that their children and possessions should be hidden in forests and their fighting men had better be got ready just in case the Romans attack. So they've really terrified these people.
Mm.
And this, I think, was Caesar's plan all along, this intimidation by bridge, to strike, as he puts it, to strike terror into the Germans, to take vengeance on the Sugambri and to deliver the Ubi from the state of blockade. It's all worked.
But now that he's got his point across, he's gone, right, I've got an entire country over there that I should be worried about, the Gauls.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm going too far into German territory.
But also we know that he can only justifiably be over the Rhine long enough to keep the threat out of Gaul, and that presumably this would stretch his troops as well.
Mm.
So he's got other fish to fry, as it were, and he doesn't need to do more. And he's going to tear that bridge down.
Yeah.
He's going to leave it there for the Germani to cross.
Well, why would you? But so we're told that he spends 18 days over in that territory, then comes back and, as you say, takes the bridge down, which seems like a big waste of resources, but I guess it's done what you wanted it to do. Mm-hmm. And you can't leave it behind.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there as a trade route. It's going to cause more trouble than it's worth if it stays there.
I feel like the Romans were sort of used to this because even back home at this point, and in fact it'll change this year, in the city of Rome there's no permanent theatre, so they're always putting up wooden theatres and tearing them down just for one particular festival and then it's gone.
Yeah, so they're used to temporary structures.
Yeah.
We're going to leave this here, cliffhanger, with a little bit of chapter 20. So with only a small part of the summer was left, and in these regions, as all Gaul has a northerly aspect,
the winters are early. But for all this, Caesar was intent on starting for Britain. Well, I believe on that exciting note, we will leave it there.
Oh.
No. Always keep them wanting more. Until the next dispatch, enjoy your day and remember to whip your slave. Ave, Ave.